then they got the guitar out, you know, rainbow strap and all, arms in the air, singing in tongues, all sorts of mad stuff going on. But then some fella got up to speak, and I can't remember what he said, but I just remember thinking, you actually believe all this stuff? You believe this?
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Our guest today has been on quite some journey. Starting out life as a builder, he became a Baptist minister and then also a stand-up comedian before, sadly, cancer stopped all of those things. He's been through an extraordinary amount of medical treatment and has written a book about all his experiences. Our guest today is Alan Finnegan. Alan, welcome to The Profile.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Chris. Gareth, for having me. Just called you Chris then. No idea. That's why.
People have called me worse. Don't worry.
Yeah.
I was Gazza in my youth.
Okay.
Even before Gazza the footballer came
around. Yeah, yeah.
So I claim that one.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to say in advance, Alan, that there might be some tears for me today. And I mean that because when I read your book through in one sitting on a train to London, I was laughing out loud and crying because I was laughing so much. And then also I was sobbing, crying quietly. Fortunately, everyone was being very British on the train and everyone just ignored me, basically, which was fine by me. But, you know, who knows how this conversation will go, because your book does go deep. It's called I Didn't Ask for Any of This, Church, Comedy and Cancer, and it's out in January, and I highly recommend it. And we'll come on to that in a minute, Alan, but I just wanted to start with your early life, if we can. Just go back and you think about your upbringing, which you do talk about a fair bit in your book. So where are you from? What was life like growing up?
I'm from a place called Bootle in North Liverpool, which at one point in the scale of deprivation that I now know exists, was the second most deprived place in the country behind Speke, which is also in Liverpool, funny enough. But having said that, I knew no different what it was like, because it was just home to me. It was how everyone grew up. You know, it was how every school was run. It was just the way life was. I only found out life was different when I became a Christian and started to kind of travel around a bit more to different things and conferences and that. And I seen people and their stories, and I was like almost bemused, to be honest. Looking back now, it was a bit of a rough place to grow up, but actually at the time, it was great. It was all right, you know. Life was just the way, that's the way life was for me. So that was early life, you know. And I think there's a song by James which says, if I hadn't seen such riches, I could live with being poor. Until kind of I seen things and I went to places like Guildford and I was like, goodness, what's this place? There's jobs. I had no comparisons, so life was fine, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I know that things like class can be difficult to define and discuss, but would you wear that label of being working class? Would that be something you would identify as?
Oh, yeah, I'd definitely wear that label of working class, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
I'd definitely wear that label. And probably proudly, because of my upbringing. Christianity has a way of making you think more middle class. You never make it middle class, but it makes you, it changes your values slightly, and I'm not over happy with that nowadays. Working class, definitely, I would say, yeah.
Well, maybe we'll come on to that interesting question. Is the church middle class? But just leaning into your upbringing, when was this, if I may ask? What, you in the 80s, 70s?
Well, I left school in the 80s. I left school in 83, so it was like late 60s, 70s, 80s, growing up in Bootle in a two up, two down terraced house in a, you know, a little compact street. There wasn't any cars, I think. We weren't bad. My mum and dad both worked, so they kind of had to. But you know, we were one of the first people to get a telephone in the street. So we were doing all right, you know. We were top of the tree kind of thing. Not quite, I'm only messing. But Yeah, it was. I enjoyed that. It's all been knocked down now.
Right.
Every bit of it, except my school.
Yeah.
My infant school's been knocked down. My house has been knocked down. All the houses around it have been knocked down and rebuilt differently. They didn't even rebuild our street. They built most of the other streets back up and kept the names. But and the school, they partially knocked down, but obviously wanted to keep it as a monument to failure or something. I don't know.
So yeah. You're speaking very warmly of your upbringing there. And I know we can always... you know, we can always demonize the past or look back very, very nostalgically and through sepia lenses and see it all as positive. Yeah. You definitely experienced it as a good time.
Yeah, it's because of that not knowing any different, if you get what I'm saying. I'm sure if I'd have known different, I'd have thought, nah, not all schools are like this, you know. That's what I thought later on in life when I went to a conference later on in life, and it was only a small conference, and it was a men's conference, and I remember talking to people my age and that, and they'd all been to university, and I honestly was flabbergasted because I didn't even, that wasn't even in my vocabulary, that wasn't even a thing that you did. I had no idea what it was. In some ways I knew they existed, but I didn't know what for, and there was no way I was ever even contemplating going to university. You left school and you got a job if you could. It was hard. It was the 80s. There wasn't any, you know, a lot of people left Liverpool at that time to find employment. And so I ended up, that's how I ended up on building sites. That wasn't a choice. My dad worked in the offices on building sites, so could get me a job kind of thing. Do you get what I mean? So
there's that saying that you can't be what you can't see. And do you think that is kind of what you explained there, where your vision was limited to what was around you?
Absolutely. I would say that's true. You can't. I mean, you didn't think about being anything else. Now there's so many choices because social media. People's eyes have been opened to the world, haven't they, and everything. And that can be a positive and a negative in some ways, because that is the bit where you see everybody else's life and go, "Wow, mine's rubbish, isn't it?" kind of thing. And that's probably one of the reasons why people suffer with mental health and stuff like that. But at that time, you just, if you were clever, you went to somewhere called the Gyro, right? Which was at a bank in Liverpool. It also wrote the social security checks out for your weekly dole. If you were thick, you went to a factory floor or a building site or something, or you threw the Gyro off the clever people from school. So, that was it. You know, there wasn't many options at all.
And or most people
move most out.
People, yeah, moved out or stay local with those jobs. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's dig into the challenges and the positives. So, you know, obviously the challenges would have been things like limited job opportunities, limited vision, no opportunities for further education. What other sorts of challenges were there growing up?
Surviving without getting your head kicked in.
I mean, that was a very real threat day to day for you, feeling like that.
Yeah. You wouldn't go certain ways or walk certain places because it could be detrimental to your well-being, you know what I mean? So you knew that and stayed away from them. And if you stayed away, you were generally all right, but sometimes they just, like, certain gangs of people or certain individuals will come into where you were and want to cause trouble. That was a challenge. There was just nothing in the 80s in Liverpool. It was bad. I remember watching the Black Stuff thing, and if you go back and I think it's called Dougie's Last Stand or someone's Last Stand, and they take him to the Albert Dock before it's redone, which is now like World Heritage Site, or it used to be till they built Everton Stadium and they took it off us. You can't understand how bad it is. And I worked on the Albert Dock redoing it when they were regenerating it, you know what I mean? As a kid, that was one of the first jobs I got on a building site, brushing up all day for days on end, just brushing endlessly. There was nothing. So there was no aspiration in that. The only thing we had was football teams that were doing well at the time. which was quite good. Both of them, I'm a Liverpool fan, by the way, but so we did a bit better than Everton. But there was no, and I guess music was born out of that in some ways as well, you know, later on. But I couldn't play guitar, so I was stuck with a shovel.
And do you have siblings? You're growing up with brothers and sisters?
No, I'm an only child. Right. It was just me, which probably helps with the introvertism and things like that. You know, I'm probably quite comfortable just being me. It's easier than sharing space with people. So, yeah, none of that.
But no older brother to learn off. You had to learn everything from you and your friends.
Yeah. No older brother, no. No older brother to look after you in school or anything like that, neither. So luckily I had a cousin that was a bit older than me, who was known in the area a bit more as a thug. So I was slightly protected from some stuff, which was good, particularly in school. They'd say things like, yeah, just because you're his cousin, you know, doesn't mean we won't beat you up. And I'd go like, no, you won't.
Nice, so that to have was good.
Yeah, it wasn't bad, yeah. He was mad, like.
Looking beyond the, if I hadn't seen such riches, I could live with being poor. I mean, what were the positives there? You know, did you have, was it good friends as a football team? But other things that you remember fondly?
The positives of where I grew up was probably community.
Right.
You know, the... You knew each other. You didn't always get on with each other in the street, but you knew each other in the street, quite a small street. You knew each other in the area. Everyone sort of knew each other. There was a bit of a sense of looking out for each other. You know, people shared stuff a bit more. Probably community was a good positive. Now I think about it, because a lot of people just live behind closed doors now, don't they? I would say community is the biggest positive. Think of anything else, can't remember. No.
Okay. So becoming a Baptist minister was definitely never on the cards, but we're going to journey towards that now. But obviously you don't suddenly become a Baptist minister having moved off a building site and not being a Christian. So why don't you just sort of outline how you became a Christian and then where Baptist ministry came into it?
I met a girl in a party. In the book, I go into more detail about something that happened to me when I was younger. I'd started going to Boys Brigade. I think my mum and dad just wanted to get rid of me. And church holidays, you know, holidays with the Boys Brigade meant you had to go to church and that. But and I'd kind of made a decision when I was quite young. Didn't know what that meant really at some point. But then when I was 16, I met a girl who I ended up marrying, Joyce. So her mum and dad and her, but she'd sort of stopped going to church at this point, went to church, and they were on at her to get me to go to church. And it's actually the church I'm now the minister of, right? So it's the only church I've ever been in, really. I've never been in, I've been in other churches, but I've never been like in a, you know, a member or whatever you want to call it, of another church. And so we basically went just to shut them up. And it was pretty dire, I've got to be honest with you. It wasn't very good. but it shut them up. They were kind of happy that I was turning up at church. We went to the afternoon service, was handy, because after that we then went to pub. That was the deal. I'll go to church to shut your mum and dad up, but then we're going to pub afterwards. So that's what we did. But because of that, the dad invited me somewhere, which there was this mad meeting at the time called Full Gospel Business Men's Fellowship International. Rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? And he invited me to this meal in the Park Hotel, which is, it was up the road from the church. And I thought, how bad can it be? I'll go. And I went, and it was mad. they were quite charismatic, you know what I mean? And their church wasn't. I kind of knew about it a bit, but in the main, their church was quite traditionalish, you know. I went, and there was this dinner, which was fine, and then they got the guitar out, you know, rainbow strap and all. And everyone sort of went a bit crazy. Like, I was sat in my chair just looking around, bemused at what was happening, arms in the air, singing in tongues, all sorts of mad stuff going on. But then some fella got up to speak. His name was Paul Gennadu, I think. And he was a convert from Islam to Christianity. And I can't remember what he said, but I just remember thinking to myself, you actually believe all this stuff? You believe this? This isn't something you're just sort of saying. This is something that has completely and utterly changed your life, and you believe it. And I thought to myself, if that's Christianity and that's about God, that's what I want. And so I was sitting there thinking that, and they did the usual sneaky thing, you know, let's all close our eyes, and if you want to become a Christian, put your hands up. And I did, weirdly enough, put my hands up, because I was looking around and no one had their eyes on me. I would nowadays, like, but I thought that was that, but then no, those who've put your hands up, come forward. And I was painfully shy. Painfully shy. I'm not sure that comes out in the book as much as I am actually painfully shy. But I thought, not a chance am I doing that. And I sort of was going lower in my chair, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And anyway, a few people got up, and then he went, there's one more person who hasn't put their hands up. And I was like, oh, come on, mate, give it up. And literally, someone got up from the back and went forward. So I was off the hook. I was like, wow. Anyway, a week later, I know this has taken a long time, but a week later, I'd walked me then girlfriend, now wife, home. She lived in a better part of Bootle. it was a bit of a walk away. So I walked there home, and we were a little bit early. I would say 10:22, quarter 10. She had to be in at 10 that time. And she said to me, do you want a coffee before you go? And I went, yeah, go on then. So we went in, and within a short space of time, three people knocked on the door. And there was no mobile phones to WhatsApp people to get around them days, you know what I mean? It wasn't a setup. But her dad was unwell. He'd had heart problems. And they all came with a similar story, which was basically one was driving past, one was in the house, one was the minister of the church, and they all came and basically said, I felt God told me to come to your house tonight. And I'm sitting there with what I can only describe as the hottest cup of coffee. I'm in the living room. They're all in the living room with the dad. And so we've come, you know. And Roy's like, oh, right, weird. Can't, because there was a little spaced out, but it's getting late. And he said, we'll pray for you. Anyway, they knelt down on the mat in front of me, and I'm just like, wow. But anyway, and then one of them spoke in tongues, which I'd seen in this crazy meeting the week before. So it didn't quite freak me out. The only thing that I remember about that is that when they finished, all of them turned around and just looked at me. It was like they understood what he said. I never. And one of them said, God says we've got to deal with you first. And I was like, you can just take me now. But what they did that wasn't done the week before was they explained what the gospel was, that Jesus had died so that I could be saved, kind of thing, to put it short. And so I prayed that night with them. And that's how I got into it. And it was full on from that moment for quite a while. It was full on from that moment. I nearly got arrested on the way home by the police and stuff like that because I was running because I was late. And there'd be burglaries in the area and all this sort of stuff. And I think they gave up when I said, I've just been saved. I think they thought, oh, he's crap. Just let him go. Can't be bothered with the paperwork.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you then go through really great, really lovely, interesting detail about your involvement with the church and the struggles that were there, and how you took on more and more responsibility. Yeah. And the pastor, the minister, left, and you ended up essentially being the pastor, being the minister without actually being formally the minister, and how the Baptist church had very formal kind of rules around how to get ministers, you know, sort of approved. And that was quite a frustrating process. You hadn't been to college and all the rest of it. I do want to zero in, just jumping forward a little bit, into where you talk about being not quite sure of yourself, I think, as a minister. I mean, you do talk about being well-liked. People seem to like you. And you seem to have a love for people and also a gift for preaching. But then also you seem very unsure about whether or not you were ever really a very good minister. So I wanted to just ask you what that was all about, because it seems like you were doing a good job, but you doubted whether you were doing a good job or not.
I guess it comes from the old insecurities of childhood and all that kind of stuff and growing up and all that. But it also comes from comparison. Comparing myself with the previous minister who had done a really good job but had left, you know, and splits and things like that. And I wasn't him. And that might have been a good thing in some ways, but for the criticisms he got for certain things. But I wasn't him, and I wasn't charismatic enough, and I didn't know my Bible enough, and lots of things, and I felt that I wasn't holy enough. It was kind of a small charismatic holiness kind of type church at the time, evangelical. And I knew my own flaws. You never spoke about them, of course, because then, and so I didn't feel that I could do it. But that's probably dogged me in every area of my life. So not just church. And I'd do stupid things, like I'd go to visit someone whose husband had died, and like I'd forget to pray for them and things like that. You know, it's like 101 of being a minister. And then they'd say to me, "Aren't you going to pray for me before you go?" And I'd be like, "Oh dear me." I'd turn up at people's houses to visit them when they'd been sick for a while, and they'd be dead. And I'd be just like, "Oh dear me," knocking on the door and they're dead. You know what I mean? I was just terrible at it in my eyes.
Yeah, but is a lot of that more to do with your eyes rather than what was actually going on? Because everyone makes mistakes.
Yeah, I think it probably was. It probably is. But it didn't make me feel any better about it, if you get what I mean. It probably is more about how I thought people perceived me rather than actually how people perceived me.
What can people who are in churches now do to help their pastor who might be feeling similarly?
It's a difficult, it depends the culture of the church, because if they'd have praised me, I'd have felt even weirder. Because we were almost, so, you know, I'd found my tribe in lots of ways. You were never good enough. You know what I mean? Anything that you did do good was God. And anything that you did bad was definitely you. So, like, if they praised you more, I guess, I mean, all people are different. But for me, it probably would have made me feel better. But I guess appreciating people, a pastor, is a bit more, because you're living your life, but a minister's probably dealing with 90% misery and 10% positive stuff. Do you get what I mean? When I say misery, tragedy, stuff,
difficulties.
And so, but you're dealing with lots of other people's, never mind your own. And they get all right. Something happens and there's a breakthrough. Something happens, you know, even if it's not good, but something resolves that issue. But then there's another one for you to deal with. And you don't get a break from that in some ways. And you get used to it a little bit. But it can definitely take its toll. I think that's why a lot of ministers don't last long in churches. They move on to a new place, and because you then get 6 to 12 months where everyone loves you and it's a bit easier and all that. I never got that. I never got a honeymoon period because I was already there. In fact, it was probably worse. But I think appreciate your minister, realise that they're just you. But the problem is, in the likes of our church, we built the minister up so much that they were almost expected to be perfect, or that was the perception.
Yeah. So appreciate them, but also allow them to be human.
Yeah, absolutely allow them to be human. One of the things I've done in the last maybe 10 years is to deliberately, not everything, but deliberately share my frustrations with myself, my struggles, my failures, to deliberately downplay my holiness, to deliberately, and I kind of learned that through comedy in some ways, because you can't laugh at what you can't relate to. And I realized in Christianity, they weren't relating to this. This minister was someone special there, because that's how I thought about the previous minister. And you also find out a lot of ministers feel exactly the same as I do. They feel they're a fraud and they're just going to get rumbles one day, and they're just waiting for that day to happen kind of thing. So I always had a backup plan to go back on the building. I actually went more vulnerable. It was a response, a deliberate response to almost burnout through trying to pretend to be perfect all the time, and pretend to know everything all the time, and be the font of knowledge and the, you know, we wouldn't say this nowadays, but the man of power for the hour kind of thing. Yep. In the church and all that, and the one who's got all the answers, all the prayers work kind of thing. And the weight of that was just far too much. And I realized we were projecting that onto others. And so they were hiding stuff that they, and once I started doing it, you'd almost get the collective, thank goodness it's not just me.
Yeah.
And comedy's the same. It's often, you know, is it Michael McIntyre talks about the man's top drawer. There's a top drawer in your, and it's got batteries in and keys. You've got no idea what for. And everyone's got one, and everyone goes, no one's really thought about it, but they can recognize it. And so I started doing that a lot more with my communication and a lot more with my life, within reasons, obviously, because you don't want the whole pack of cards to come crumbling down. but I definitely learned from that. So that, let you realize your minister's as human as you are.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
See, you've tilted at your comedy there a couple of times. Let's move on to talk about that. One of the things I loved about your book was all the detail that came out of your journal, and I want to spare something for people when they buy your book. So let's not go into too much of that. There's so much great material in there. But let's just track back and just say, you know, why did you embark on that in the first place? You're a minister by now. You've got a young family, so you don't have a lot of time on your hands. So
I'm doing a degree as well.
Yeah, doing a degree. Yeah. So why the stand-up comedy?
I was basically in a preaching class. Homiletics is the proper word, but preaching class. And we were getting told by the tutor that preaching is at its day. No one communicates, one person, one microphone anymore. And I'd just been to see Peter Kay in the Echo Arena in Liverpool. And I was like, nah, you're wrong. And that's why I interjected and said, I think you're wrong. I think it's never been more culturally appropriate. I said, one person, one microphone. After just being seen, Peter Kay, he has 11,000 people shouting for more after an hour and a half with only a break in the middle. I said, so I think you're wrong. I think it's what we say when we've got the microphone in our hands. That's the problem. And that led to a learning objective, which was to attend a comedy course, which there are such things, and do that, and then compare and contrast comedy and preaching, you know, as an art form, as an essay then. And so I went on that, no intent. I'd never been in a comedy club, not a proper one. I'd only been to the arena things, you know, never been in a real comedy club, no intentions of ever being a comedian, just went, did the course, did all right, wrote the essay, compared and contrasted it, came to some conclusions. But then someone booked me on the back of my first performance to go and do this little gig in Southport, which is just up the road from Bootle. And it was there was probably less than 15 people in it. This is the reality at the beginning. and 8 of them were acts, so they're not interested. And then some fella who was on the course with just said, me and you are going to go around booking gigs. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, whatever. And if he hadn't done that, I would never have done it. I would never have looked to book. I didn't even know what you did to book a gig. That's how it started, and he kept doing that. He was rubbish, by the way, but he was. I can say that because he's dead now, but he was rubbish, yeah. And so I ended up going on my own because I was getting asked to go without him to places, which was a bit awkward. But because we used to try, I used to pick him up because he couldn't drive, and
So again, we won't go into, we'll save the details for people when they read your book, but in terms of your act, which was basically not just to do stand-up, but do stand-up as a church minister. So that was your content and your delivery, which was great to see. Just wanted to ask you about you've tilted at this a little bit already, the similarities between stand-up and preaching. There are a few preachers who are stand-up comedians. So I wonder what the similarities are between the two.
Well, the reason why I said it's never been more culturally appropriate for us. We're trained to do this. We're trained to stand up in front of people and speak. And those that are good at it, and not everyone is, but those that are good at it. Do you get what I'm saying? They can hold the crowd. Now, it's a different crowd, a comedy audience, but the similarity, I mean, just holding the microphone in the right place, you know, and instead of moving it everywhere and you can't hear them. Having the way you use your voice and your tone to make a point and pausing at the right amount of time. We've learned all that. Maybe just it's just experience. So we're already partway there, 50, 60, 70% of the way there in terms of just being able to get on stage. People are terrified to speak in front of people. We're there. This is a prime mission field for us, right? But the problem is, if you go in and talk about Christianity, you're a weirdo, because the culture in the places is atheist. Mostly the clubs, not necessarily the audiences, the clubs are very atheist. I basically got told I got away with it because I talked about my job. If I wasn't a vicar, as they called me, everyone would think I was just a weirdo.
Right.
So I was allowed to do it. And they say, speak about what you know. So it's easy to, and that perspective was a unique perspective. It's a bit like Marmite. People either loved it or hated it. You get what I mean? But in general, it went down well, really well, because it was a different perspective on life. And I brought into it all that how bad I am as a minister, you know what I mean? So that really helped.
And it went well, so you ended up on Britain's Got Talent into the semi-final.
Yeah, surprisingly. I just didn't want to make a show of myself in the first one, never mind. I made a show of myself in the second one. But I just didn't want to make a show of myself on that. I didn't know why I was there. In fact, I think they were scraping the barrel by season 14 or whatever it was I was on. Yeah, I ended up on Britain's Got Talent. That was a thing I'll never forget, I suppose. The Primark shoes they bought me to wear on stage because they wouldn't let me wear me proper trainees. London Palladium, that was the highlight, the London Palladium. It was really terrifyingly, but special. I remember walking down the road afterwards thinking, did that just really happen to me? And I had no one to talk to. I was on my own. In London, I had to stay the night because the trains, you can't get back to Liverpool from London. The last train's like 8 minutes past eight or something like that. They didn't let me out till about half nine. So you can't get home. So yeah, I had to stay. And it was just like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, mad, mad time. Yeah.
And off a high like that, we end up at some point with a cancer diagnosis. Narrate us that story. Again, there's lots of detail in the book, but
yeah,
how does that come about? What happened?
Well, we went straight into COVID. It was during COVID, the BGT thing that happened. So what would have normally have been the biggest break in my life, even if I wasn't that good, I'd have got gigs just because my name would have sold tickets, if you understand what I mean. There was no gigs. No gigs. And my confidence during that time was low because I wasn't gigging. And I started the old kind of, oh, you can't do this, what are you doing, quit, kind of feelings come in. And when I started sort of getting back into it, but I'd noticed a flicker in my eye and just going a bit funny, my eye, everything. Like something was in the side view and you kept looking, there was nothing there and it was going duller. And I already had an eye exam coming up, so I mentioned it while I was there. Long story short, they decided to take another look and found what was called a freckle in my eye. I mean, a freckle in your eye. I was like, what are you on about? So they said, oh, no, it can be serious. Don't be alarmed. We're going to send you to see the oncologist. That's the word you want to hear, isn't it? At the eye hospital in Liverpool. So I went, not thinking much of it, really. Again, it's COVID, I'm on my own. And it was, while I was there, they were looking in the wrong eye all the time. They were looking in my right eye and my problems were in my left. And I just mentioned it to the doctor when I was there. I said, you keep looking in the wrong eye, you know. And he went, what do you mean? I said, all my problems are in the other eye. And he went, oh, I'll see you look while you're here. And then he basically said to some other fellow who looked like he was just observing, he said, this is classic. Look at this. This is classic tumour. And then he realised I was sat there and he went, oh, can you just go out a minute? And then he brought me back in. And then the nurses come and say, is anyone with you? Are you going to go in and see the proper doctor? So, you know, there's something going on. I had ocular melanoma, it's called, basically eye cancer in the eye. And I was thinking, how bad can that be? It's only your eye. Your eye's dead little. And the tumour's even littler because it's in your eye. Apparently it's deadly. I found out quite quickly. That knocks. A, you're not allowed to drive after you've had the operations and stuff, all the details in the book. That knocked my confidence because I hadn't gigged for so long. I had to say I couldn't do gigs. And so I got in my head that I couldn't gig anymore, that I was no good at it again, you know, usual kind of nonsense that my head tells me. That fear then sort of paralysed me, I would say. And I found out all the details of what ocular melanoma is. I found out that the statistics were not very good if you had a particular gene, which of course I had. And that kind of journey then started, which again, as you say, it's detailed in the book. So I don't really want to go on too much. We're probably running out of time. Everything seemed to sort of start closing down. Everything that I felt was me at that time started to close down. Kind of started with comedy probably first. Then probably church was next, and then the building in latter times. The building stuff, when I say building, DIY, everything, do you get what I mean? Not just being able to go. The building was always my escape route for when I got rumbled for not being a good minister and I wasn't quite good enough to be a professional comedian. So I could always go back and do concrete.
So how then has this impacted your, you know, you've lost the comedy, you've lost the church role, you've lost the ability to do the building work. How's all this impacted your life and your faith and your views of God?
Well, it's it's mad because of the Christianity that I bought into, was brought into, sorry. We were all told, you're special, which I kind of believe.
Yeah.
And God's got a plan for your life. And particularly, you think you're special, especially if you end up becoming a minister in sort of weird ways. And God's got this plan for your life, and he wants you to do something that only you can do, and all this kind of stuff. And then to be flawed with this, it does affect your faith. It has to. The biggest problem I had was I couldn't say God didn't exist. If I could have said, I don't think I believe in God anymore, that probably would have been easier to deal with, because I wouldn't have had to answer the questions as to, so how do I make sense of this now with my life? But I couldn't. I just couldn't. I couldn't get to that point. Not even close, to be fair. So I had to rethink my faith through, which in some ways I'm still doing a little bit, but I'm kind of happier where I'm at, that God is still there. It's just my perception of God originally is now feels deeper in a weird way. I think I've got one more sermon left in me possibly, but I kind of know what it's going to be about, and it's probably I might write it soon, but it's more on the kind of lament type of stuff, which you don't normally do in church. You want people to go, well, I want people to go away feeling all right about themselves. There's enough people go away feeling terrible about themselves, or we used to, you know, do more, be better, try harder kind of messages that we get quite frequently. I want people to go away thinking, you know what, I'm doing all right. Yeah, it definitely changed my thing. And I think I write in the book about not comparing it to the exile, because that's obviously massive, but the kind of why, how they had to rebuild their faith after the exile. And I've had to kind of do that because I couldn't say there wasn't a God. That was the biggest conclusion out of it all. I still can't. And I still see some beautiful moments. I still don't understand it all. But I still see the goodness of God in things, and the goodness of God's people in things. And it humbles you more, I guess, when you think you're special. You're into yourself a little bit more, and that goes against everything I am, if you get what I mean, because I'm an introvert. I'm a kind of loner. I'm socially awkward if I go into a room where I don't know people. I'm really shy. You wouldn't believe that, because I'm a comedian. But weirdly, when you're a comedian and you're on stage, you're on your own. It's actually quite comforting, because you're on your own. It's weird. I had to rethink my faith in the light of there is a God, but this has happened. And I wasn't expecting this to happen, because I'd been told all this about myself and how God thought of me. And I'm not saying God doesn't think them things, but there's a deeper richness to God. I fully kind of, I've been really reflecting on Jesus on the cross, where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I'm like, wow. Jesus said that. There's a depth of emotion and feeling there that is so real. But there's more to it than I've ever thought about in the past. And it's only my experiences that are making me think about these things. The Garden of Gethsemane, things like that, you know. The Psalms. Yeah. It's definitely changed my faith, and I would say for a better, richer way, even though it's very difficult going through the situations that have led to it, and everything that I thought defined me has gone. So you have the time to just take this for just being you, which is a bit weird.
You also say that you're the cancer years have been the best years of your life because you had to reevaluate and spend more time with friends and family. So I'd like to just, I'd just like to sort of tilt to the family angle now. And as editor of Next Gen, Primer's online magazine, Christian Parents, I'm always interested in that angle. So you've got two grown up daughters.
Yes.
They're both married now, and you've got one grandchild. So you're a grandfather.
One grandchild,
as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So just thinking about it holistically, what words would you use to describe your thoughts and feelings on being a dad? What's it been like? What words come to mind?
The very first word I thought was responsibility. Suddenly I had this child in my hand, the first one, our Rachel. And I was thinking, I've got to look after this now. It's on me. It's not on anyone else. I've got to make sure she survives. Do you get what I mean? So a huge amount of responsibility. That changed me life. And when it doesn't always feel like this, but it's also a privilege to be a dad. They can do your head in, don't get me wrong, especially in the teenage years and all that type of stuff. Oh my. But if you stick through it, then that, you know, we're all really close still. It's quite good. We see each other regularly. They still live quite close. It's good now. It's great now. We go on holidays together and things like that. It's a really good thing. But responsibility, I would say, and it sort of grew me up. Originally, I grew up, when we had the second child, and I was just like, sleep, I need sleep. One child's bad. Two's like, there's no comparison. No one trains you for this. They just give you a baby and you've got to get on with it. It's a responsibility, but also it's a privilege as well. As I said, you don't always see that when you're going through it, but looking back, there's a privilege you get to shape these little lives. They don't always do what you want them to do, and they don't always turn out the way you want them to do. I'm not saying mine are bad. I'm not saying that at all. But, you know, they make choices for their own, and they've got to. Sticking with them and all that kinds of stuff.
So some of the challenges are a lack of sleep and taking that responsibility on. What about challenges in terms of nurturing faith in your two girls? And you know, you've got a particular angle being a minister, what challenges have there been?
I didn't become a minister probably until they were about 13, one of them, maybe 15, the other one. So we took them. That was probably a terrible age for me to become a minister for them, because they were in school and their dad's a minister. They didn't tell anyone I was a minister when they were in school. They just told them I was a builder. They found out later on. So, what was it? We took them to church. We were full on. If there was a meeting, I was definitely at it. You know what I mean? But we'd go to everything. And the church was, in the early days, was quite vibrant, quite a lot of stuff going on, community stuff, community days, lots of church days out. So there was a kind of extended family for them there, and extended siblings, shall we say. And so they enjoyed all that. And as they're little, they do it, and they think, you know, your mum and dad know everything, and everything they say is right, you know what I mean? So they kind of quickly buy into everything you do. And that's good. That is really good. They get a bit older and want to question that, and then every generation does it, I imagine, and they want to make their own minds up on things, and they have their own will and things like that, and so it was easier when they were younger. As they got into senior school, that became more difficult, but I quickly realised it was better to be flexible and keep your kids liking you, then force them to go somewhere they didn't want to go. And my eldest wanted to go most of the time. The youngest didn't as much. I think the flexibility helped with that. She felt it was her decision then, rather than me making them go. Don't get me wrong, that was a process of coming to a few arguments and stuff, and then thinking, maybe I've just got to like be flexible, or they're going to hate me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think we should be doing things that cause them to hate us. I think we should love our kids unconditionally, and then they'll hopefully like you back.
And Alan, if you could wind the clock back,
yeah,
to the day before your first child was born, what advice would you give yourself?
Probably be around more. Don't be. It's going to sound terrible for church. Don't be too busy with the church as much. Definitely get more sleep. Definitely get more sleep. Sleep when baby sleeps. That's a great advice. But probably be around more, particularly in the key moments. I know you've got to earn money to provide and all that kinds of stuff, but we had far too many meetings at church that were, they weren't needed. It became our social bubble. I must have been at church at least five nights a week. And it was almost expected, or you weren't committed enough, if you get what I'm saying. And that has to have an impact. My wife would be with me sometimes, we'd get them babysat. And so you're kind of not in for your kids. And this is a story I hear quite a lot from the children now, of people my generation. It was like, my mum and dad weren't in. They were more interested in church than me. These are the ones who don't really want to go to church anymore, or have sort of a little bit scared to get overcommitted. You know what I mean? Because they know what happened to them. So they undercommit. And then, so they only come to church once a month or something. And then the kids don't want to come because it's not their routine and part of their life. So the positive was, it was our routine, part of the lives our kids went. The negative of this generation is probably that they're scared of commitment in that way. And so they do it less, but then it affects that kind of faith thing, I think, a little bit. I'm speaking a bit too general. Yeah.
Alan, that's great. And it's been such a privilege to hear parts of your story. I know a lot more, of course, having read the book, and I do encourage you, if you're listening in, to go and get Alan's book. It's out in January, so it'll have to be a New Year present, not a Christmas present. But the book is I Didn't Ask for Any of This, Church, Comedy and Cancer. Alan Finnegan, thank you so much for being our guest on The Profile. It's been such a blessing and a privilege to speak with you today.
Yeah, it's available for pre-order now as well, if you wanted to, on Broad Place Publishing. You'll find that on the internet. Yeah.
Get out there and pre-order it. Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.